The dressing room I knew best was the one at Studio 6 at CBC, a little tiny room that three people could sit side by side and be made up if the makeup artist stood behind them. And then the green room made the dressing room, makeup room, look glamorous. So we never put anybody in there unless we really didn't like them. And we'd cram them into our makeup room. And it was, strange.
Adrienne Clarkson talking about dressing rooms she has known before delivering the fourth of the 2014 CBC Massey Lectures in Vancouver. I'm Paul Kennedy. Welcome to Ideas. All this week, we're bringing you the five talks in the series titled Belonging, the Paradox of Citizenship. The Massey Lectures feature the best minds of our time, discussing issues that confront us all, both as Canadians and as global citizens. Each year, we go on the road to record the Masseys in front of live audiences. This year's speaker is Adrienne Clarkson, and we went along with her as she traveled to Montreal, Halifax, Saskatoon, Vancouver, and Toronto.
Most makeup rooms everywhere look the same. It doesn't matter whether they're for the National Theatre of Great Britain or whether they're at the NAC or at the Royal Alexander. They all look tacky and kind of reflect the history of the theatre, which is of people who were basically not very legitimate, were scamps, were people who stole things. They couldn't have anything that could be moved in them because they'd be carried away, obviously. And it was a nice atmosphere, really, that kind of feeling that you were a little bit lawless.
Adrienne Clarkson is a former Governor General of Canada and a longtime TV journalist and host. She's also an author. She's written three books, including a biography of Norman Bethune. Along with her husband, John Ralston Saul, she co-founded the Institute for Canadian Citizenship. In this year's Massey Lectures, she explores a theme near to her heart, what it means to be a citizen. This is the fourth installment of the 2014 CBC Massey Lectures. It's called Ubuntu. Recorded in Vancouver, here's Adrienne Clarkson.
Thank you very much, Rick. And good evening to you all in this gorgeous hall. And I've spoken in it once before, and I'm really glad to be back here, back at the University of British Columbia, back in Vancouver, in your typical climate, and enjoying it all. Also, I've always loved radio. When I was 8 years old, my parents gave me a maroon Bakelite radio, which I had in my bedroom, and they never told me not to turn it on. They didn't know what I was listening to. And they always enjoyed hearing my accounts of it in the morning. And I loved radio. I loved listening to those voices, particularly in the dark. And I loved listening to Stage 48, Stage 49, Stage 50, these wonderful radio plays. All the great classics were adapted for it, and I used to hear beautiful voices of people like Barry Morse and Bud Knapp and Ruth Springford, and think that they were the most wonderful things. I thought radio was a magical, magical medium. And interestingly enough, although I have been associated and worked for public broadcasting at the CBC all my career, I have never done a radio program. I've been interviewed on radio. I've chatted with people, wonderful people like Zosky and Sheila Rogers, and you name it. But I have never done a radio program. So for me, the Massey Lectures is a first, and it seems to be quite right to return to my first true love. Ubuntu. I want you to picture a large soccer stadium filled with 100,000 people. They've come from 100 nations, some of them, for the state memorial service of Nelson Mandela, known affectionately as Madiba by his fellow South Africans. Rain pours down as though the skies also mourn this great man's death, but the crowd waves its umbrellas in excitement. The staircases are thronged with people in yellow, orange, and green. They are here for him. They are here to honor arguably the greatest human being to have lived in the past 100 years, a beacon of courage, an icon of suffering, a paragon of forgiveness. Brought up to be a chief of the Tembu Nation, Mandela used his skills as a lawyer to defy apartheid, and he spent 27 years in prison, emerging to lead his country by humble wisdom and generous example. I belong to a generation of students of the 50s and 60s who were radicalized personally by what was happening in South Africa. Although South African wine was cheap, we vowed never to drink it. Although Rothmans cigarettes were filter-tipped and glamorous, we pledged never to smoke them. Although Outspan oranges were delicious, we promised never to buy them. By boycotting products from South Africa, we felt we could help cripple their regime economically, or at the very least, make them realize that we did not condone apartheid, which had become their official government policy. When I think of how human beings treat each other, I always think of South Africa because it was the first deep awareness I had that we all belonged to each other, that it is wrong for a state to deny humanity on the basis of race. Apartheid is the antithesis of belonging, and it defined for me what we must never accept, what we must help wipe out. Rarely in my life has the difference between right and wrong been so clear as it was in those years. During apartheid, I was working for the CBC, and I went to South Africa and spent several weeks there preparing a one-hour documentary. The atmosphere was tense and eerie. Locally hired members of our crew were informants. I was officially classified as white because the evil absurdity of the regime decided that I was. Our cameraman, who was of Punjabi origin, was not classified as white and had to stay at a different hotel. Nelson Mandela had been in prison at that time for 13 years on Robben Island, and most observers, including me, felt he would die or be killed there. We didn't realize then what we know now. This man, who was born an African prince and became a lawyer, was committed to fighting the injustice being done to all black people and would learn to fight brutal inhumanity with courageous equanimity, to fight insane racism with quiet reason, and to fight unjust violence with forgiving civility. And the whole world reverberated for 25 years after with the graceful elegance of his forgiveness. After nearly 30 years, Mandela emerged from prison. He was able to look at everyone, no matter what their color, no matter what they felt about him, and engage their spirits, capture their hearts. Like his compatriot, the Nobel Peace Prize winner Desmond Tutu, he embodies the African concept of Ubuntu, arguably mankind's first social thought. Ubuntu is an ethical value that originated with the Bantu peoples and has been upheld by African societies for millennia. It is a statement of family cohesion and coherence that accommodates all living things. The concept of Ubuntu emphasizes our connectedness with each other in the past, the present, and the future. The concept tracks back through tribal Africa to prehistoric times. Several million years ago in the Great Rift Valley, one of our earliest ancestors sat by a fire, shaping humanity's first tool, a hand axe. These exquisite objects are the first utterance of a new emergent consciousness. Dig, cut, scrape, chop, pierce, hammer. Actions that speak of social organization, extended families living and working together to secure their survival. I am what I am because of what others have been in the past, and what I am now in the present will be a part of me in the future. This sense of connectedness, this symbiosis of all humanity, is the very essence of what we can be for each other and how we belong to each other. Ubuntu implies seeing another human being as yourself, and treating them as you would treat yourself, with love and respect. The Zulu proverb, Umuntu Mumuntu Ngabantu, means a person is a person because of other persons. This means that any failure to act in a human way is a failure of Ubuntu, and therefore someone who lacks Ubuntu is not really a human being. Each of us is a human being because of other human beings. We depend on each other for our well-being. It then follows that if we depend on others to be human, then we are bonded with them. It is only through others that we gain our ability to attain our full humanity. No organized religion, political ideology, or philosophical school can lay claim to Ubuntu. The Christian concept of agape, which is Greek for love, is the closest idea from the Western tradition. Agape is the evocation of the love of God for his creation. And later, it was broadly used to denote charity, love in the all-encompassing sense. If I speak with the tongues of men and angels and have not charity, I am as a tinkling cymbal. The Christian doctrine of love teaches that God loves us, his creation, and therefore we are imbued with his love and are urged to love others who are created equally by him. This is the act of grace, which is a spiritual expression of the idea of belonging. However, the emphasis here is on the individual reaching out to others, as opposed to the identification of the self coexisting among other selves, which is the concept behind Ubuntu. The idea of agape and the kindness of love promote the vitality and necessity of stepping outside oneself. It therefore follows that the cult of individualism, which is so prevalent today, can only lead to the most profound and severe personal isolation. If the individual is the only guide and center for all meaning, then society makes no sense. Some scholars who study the concept of Ubuntu today, colonial scholars, needless to say, consider the philosophy to be primitive, childlike, and leading to a culture of dependency. The idea of the interdependence of all human beings is willfully misinterpreted in order to denigrate the idea that we are mutually dependent. Where does individualism fit into this worldview? Doesn't the individual fear for her own personality if her essence as a human being depends on other human beings? Where is the triumph of the self, the triumph of ego? Some have attacked the concept of Ubuntu as standing in the way of social and economic progress, creating generations of people devoid of personal ambition or responsibility. One of the scholars, Stephen Theron, has described Ubuntu as simply sidestepping the slow Western development of the idea of personal responsibility charted in the Bible and elsewhere. Without this consciousness, he continues, the fruits of technology cannot be enjoyed. The concept of Ubuntu teaches Africans to evade responsibility and hide behind the collective decision of the tribe. The opposite of Ubuntu, then, is a particular kind of blinkered self-interest. The pull of Western economic philosophy has been strong. Political philosophers such as Thomas Hobbes, David Hume, and Adam Smith are read and very frequently misread to justify selfishness and reinforce the idea that only self-interest and greed motivate the individual. We have lived so long with the Cartesian idea of I think, therefore I am, that it has all but blinded us to the concept of what it is to be a person in all human manifestations. In the ancient world, the citizen belonged to the city, and the city belonged to the citizen. There were equal rights and obligations on the part of the group and of the individual. To be able to belong and yet able to criticize, to disagree, to withdraw consent, is quintessential to belonging, and it is a fundamental notion that has been carried down to modern times. But it must always be remembered that to subjugate all your selfhood, ideas, inclinations, and emotions in order to be part of a collective is not belonging. This kind of sacrifice to others in the group is conformity and carried to an extreme, bondage.
That's Adrian Clarkson delivering the fourth of the 2014 CBC Massey Lectures in Vancouver, called Ubuntu. In each city on the tour, we met new Canadian citizens, and we asked them about their experience of coming to Canada.
Oh, I'm Sam Mosoke, and I'm from Uganda. My wife is from Halifax, and when we married, so came here. It was easy to come to Canada. I love it. I've thought about coming here in terms of responsibilities. I started thinking more of the fact that when you get something, when you have a privilege, if you come to a country like Canada, you have responsibilities. And I felt more of responsibilities towards my neighbors, responsibilities as a citizen towards other citizens, and responsibilities as a Canadian towards other countries.
You're listening to Ideas in Canada on CBC Radio 1, on Sirius XM across North America, and around the world on cbc.ca. I'm Paul Kennedy. The South African concept of Ubuntu suggests that we are all interconnected, all living things, all people, and it is that sense of family that makes us most truly individuals.
Belonging in its truest sense means understanding the nature of the connections between one another, the very nature of interconnectedness. It can never mean dominance or submission. To define belonging is to understand its laterality. It will always move horizontally and never vertically. There is something so lonely and almost sad about thinking and being with the emphasis on the I, and it puts a terrific amount of pressure on our individual lives, wants, abilities, dreams. This emphasis on rationality undermines continually our understanding of Ubuntu. We are told in the New Testament to love one another as we are loved by God. And we are told in the Quran that we are one because we have been created by a single creator. Neither of these religions, to pick up just two that are alive here in Canada, tells us that the individual is the most important thing in the world. On the one hand, we are told to love one another as we are loved, which implies a bond of energy and need. And on the other hand, we are told that we are part of each other because one single force created us and fused us together. This means that our personhood is derived from other people, is nourished by other people, and grows with other people. The political theorist Hannah Arendt characterized this kind of feeling as being present in the willingness to act and speak at all, to insert oneself into the world and begin a story of one's own. This is not only an act of self-creation and individualism, it is a way of participating in the flourishing of society as a whole. If you have the capacity to participate in the world outside your private realm, you have begun to tell your story in a different way. This leads to acting in a different way. And acting, as Arendt points out, is never possible in isolation. To be isolated is to be deprived of the ability and the capacity to act. Arendt always goes on to say that conscientious action is the human being's exclusive prerogative, and more importantly, that action is dependent on the constant presence of others. She emphasizes that we belong to each other. If we have no speech or action, we are, as she says, dead to the world, and we have ceased to live a human life because it no longer is a life lived among other human beings. By speaking and by acting, we insert ourselves into the world. Arendt says this insertion is like a second birth. We can only tell our own story, our way of participating in the ongoing human drama of life, and we can only learn who we are or who we were by knowing the story of which we ourselves are the heroes. In our new Gilded Age, the quiet voice of Ubuntu has been drowned out in the polarizing din of right versus left politics. Communal relationships and institutions that work for the common good and represent the shared values of civil society are falling out of fashion. But none of us can ever be totally independent and self-sufficient. The responsibility and duty we owe to each other is universal. We learn very early in life that we need not only to accept help, but also to give help when it is needed. In some ways, we in Canada have actually lived the Ubuntu philosophy because our earliest concept of community comes from the Aboriginal people, upon whom we depended to learn techniques for survival when we first came to this land. Horses were no good in this land. They did not help to conquer this land the way horses helped the Spanish conquer Mexico. We had to learn how to use what the natives had, canoes. In the vision, the world vision of Aboriginal peoples, there is no separation of the individual from the group. The other is always present, and the other is not necessarily another human being, but often a manifestation of the natural world, an animal, a fish, a tree. When the Tsimshian people say they are the people of the salmon, they don't mean simply they fish for salmon, they are the salmon. Totem poles depict these integrated representations, the eagle, the bear, the fish, piled one on top of the other. And this is the integration of the most meaningful kind. I am as I am because of the way we all are together. I owe my existence to others. What is sufficient for the group is sufficient for me. It was only with the arrival of European settlers that the idea of the accumulation of wealth took root in Canada. Early Europeans who went to Africa also were amazed to have found people there who didn't believe in just gathering up wealth for themselves. We must remember here on the West Coast that in 1926, the RCMP broke up the last potlatch held by the Kwakoutl people. The potlatch being a feast in which a chief gives away large amounts of goods, showing his benevolence. By the early 20th century, these goods included sacks of flour, umbrellas, blankets, bolts of cloth. This tradition flew in the face of the established European order, the accumulation of goods for oneself, one's own family, one's own blood, one's own people. It horrified the posture of self-aggrandizing personal consumption. But the idea of sharing is much older than the concept of accumulating. We all share life, and we all participate in the same energy field, the same fundamental substance. The essence of our common humanity allows us to recognize in each other our similarities rather than differentiating ourselves by pulling away from the other. When we can be part of the other, we agree fundamentally that we are all evolving at the same pace, that all humans are equal on the evolutionary scale. It is stated in the Quran that the Creator could have made us all the same, but He did not, because the challenge of being different meant that we would have to learn how to get along with each other. The only way that we can do that is through the recognition of our common humanity. As Romeo Dallaire has said, we are all human beings, and no human being is more human than any other. But the difference must be encouraged. There are differences, it's just there isn't more. When the French philosopher Voltaire went into exile in England in 1753, he wrote that there were many different religious sects, not just Catholics and Protestants, as there were in France. And he observed, If there were only one religion in England, there would be danger of despotism. And if there were only two, they would cut each other's throats. But there are 30, and they live in peace and happiness. Little did Voltaire know that he was really describing the Canada of today. In 2010, the Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel, declared multiculturalism dead. This in a country where multicultural policy once included educating the children of Turkish guest workers in separate Turkish schools so that when they were sent home, when they were no longer useful economic units, they would not have lost their language. Compare this to a country like Canada, where 2,500 citizenship ceremonies are conducted across the country every year. Each one welcomes between 35 and 50 people from an average of about 25 different countries. And a recent survey found that 89% of Canadians believe that someone born outside the country can become a good citizen. 95% of respondents said that the primary criterion for a good citizen is the belief that men and women should be treated equally. 89% felt that in order to be a good citizen, you also have to follow the laws. 82% agreed that you have to accept others who are different. 82% also thought citizens must vote, while 80% said that you had to protect the environment. 65% of respondents said that you must respect other people's religions. 62% said that you must know something about Canada's history. Only 5% cited the quality of life as the thing that made them proud to be Canadian, and just slightly higher at 6% was being respected by other countries. The survey is fascinating because it reflects a gender-equal, law-abiding, tolerant, voting, and ecologically-minded population. But the challenge will always be to maintain our diversity, to accept and to recognize each other as part of the same family. One way in which we have failed at that difference in our society is the way we have treated and continue to treat our Aboriginal people. The First Nations and Inuit are among the three founding peoples of this country, along with the Francophones and the Anglophones. George Erasmus, the former National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, who led the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples from 1991 to 1996 and produced a marvelous report that has never been implemented, said, "The ideals of a good life are embedded in Aboriginal languages and traditional teaching. The Anishinaabeg seek the spiritual gift of Pimatsuin, long life and well-being, which enable a person to gain wisdom. The Crees of the Northern Prairies value Miyawitsetoan, having good relations. The Iroquois Great Law sets out rules for maintaining peace, Skenenkowa, going beyond resolving conflicts to actively caring for each other's welfare. Aboriginal peoples across Canada speak of their relationship with the natural world and the responsibility of human beings to maintain balance in the natural order. Rituals in which we give something back in return for the gifts that we receive from Mother Earth reinforce that sense of responsibility. Most Canadians subscribe to these same goals, long life, health, and wisdom for self and family, a harmonious and cohesive society, peace between peoples of different origins and territories, and a sustainable relationship with our natural environment." It's painful to hear these words of George Erasmus, because we have to acknowledge that we have not met these goals. As early settlers, we came upon the First Nations and then the Inuit and sought to make the ownership of property the great divide between them and us. "We own this" became the rallying cry over "we share this." I felt a personal responsibility when, as the representative of the Crown, I used to reenact treaty ceremonies, historic ones, including the one that was held at Lower Fort Garry in Winnipeg in 2001. In such ceremonies, I would reenact the role of the governor of the time, in this case, Sir George Simpson. and reverence would always be paid to me as the embodiment of the crown. When I performed these functions, Aboriginal people of all ages always addressed me as grandmother, as they would have to Queen Victoria. That treaty ceremony, reenacted in 2001, ended with the statement that this bond will hold as long as the sun shines, the rivers flow, and the grass grows. The native peoples entered into the treaties with good faith, and I would like us, whose ancestors signed those treaties, to honor them. Despite the fact that over the past 400 years, millions of immigrants have arrived on these shores and helped to build this country, we will not be able to continue to negotiate difference in our country until we have honestly fulfilled our promise to the Aboriginal people. The evidence of our betrayal is all around us, on the reserves, in the cities, in diabetes, in fetal alcohol syndrome, in teenage suicide. The history of our nation is made up of a complex network of accords and agreements. The Quebec Act of 1774, the Confederation Act of 1867, and all the treaties with the native peoples across the country. But we have not lived up to our end of the bargain. With our own First Nations, we Canadians have failed in our Ubuntu project. Citizenship is more than patriotism with privileges. We must ask more of each other than that. And it has to be balanced against the competing and compelling pull of individualism, which assumes that all individuals are independent of each other and that relationships can be abandoned when the cost-benefit ratio no longer works, in which case all relationships are impermanent, manipulative, or apathetic. Our literary critic, Northrop Frye, said, "In Canada, we participate in society by means of our imagination or the quality of our social vision. Our vision of what society is, what it could be, what it should be, are all structures of metaphor, because the metaphor is the unit of all imagination. Logical thinking in this field seldom does more than rationalize these metaphorical visions." What Frye is telling us is that we participate in each other's imagination, even if we are not consciously aware of doing so. We are part of each other's wishes, hopes, and yes, dreams. Citizenship also requires imaginative intuition that the situation of your neighbor could be your situation in the future, or in our immigrant society, that a newcomer's arrival to our country with one suitcase was your arrival in the past. As someone who came to this country with one suitcase as a refugee, I have never lost the sense that I came from that minimal place where everything had been taken away. Interestingly enough, I found that when I came here, I belonged. Robert Frost has a line in which he says, "Home is the place where when you have to go there, they've got to take you in." In that way, Canada has become home to almost everyone who comes here.
That's Adrian Clarkson delivering the fourth of the 2014 CBC Massey Lectures in Vancouver, called Ubuntu. In each city on the tour, we met new Canadian citizens, and we asked them about their experience of coming to Canada.
Okay, my name is Loy Diaz, and I originally came from the Philippines. All that everyone would talk about would be the economics and the free healthcare, and it has gone beyond that when I came here. I am particularly impressed by the diversity and how well people get along here despite all the differences. I am extremely touched by the lack of discrimination, because I have traveled in different countries, places that have such blatant discrimination, and you just don't feel that here. You can actually be who you are without trying to be whitewashed, as my kids would say. The idea of being a volunteer has also broadened my idea of what being a human being should be. despite the constant struggle for survival at this point in our immigration, there is that widening concept now that there should also be service toward humankind in general. Definitely here in Canada, that whole concept has broadened.
You're listening to Ideas in Canada on CBC Radio 1, on Sirius XM across North America, and around the world on cbc.ca. I'm Paul Kennedy. The peoples of the First Nations suggest a new idea about citizenship, that what we share is far more important than what we own.
It is part of my recognition, my belonging, that I am human and that I belong to every experience that human beings undergo. The playwright Terence, who had been brought to Rome as a slave from Carthage in the 2nd century BC, stated it very succinctly. I am human. Nothing human is alien to me. If a society is healthy, it will be able to look at what everybody believes, and it will cause those within the society to look at their own beliefs and see what foundations they have for, say, their Islam, their Christianity, their Judaism, their Buddhism, their Hinduism, or their atheism. To be able to observe others in your system and to question your own beliefs is inherently healthy. The worst thing that can happen is to reject other people's belief systems because they are not your own. This is the very basis and foundation of exclusion, because it seeks to destroy that connectedness, that community, which is Ubuntu. The concept of acceptance incorporates both understanding and tolerance. It is very important to point out that this does not mean that people set out to be good to each other. Rather, it means that the context of the human being, the individual, is always the community. So now I promote something that I call passive acceptance. Most people don't like the word passive because it seems to imply impotence and weakness or indifference. But to me, passivity is not exactly the opposite of action. The passivity I am talking about is mixed with awareness and a latent curiosity and a patience. In passive acceptance, there is watchfulness, and there has to be the desire to contextualize ourselves with other human beings around us. Often we just have to let things happen and simply observe. The evocation of emotion to resolve the issues that arise in a complex society is not useful in a diverse society. Love is not going to iron out the differences between us, and all you need is not love. Certainly, I would never question that we need love as individuals, but to talk about love as the sole means for unity misleads and deludes us about what gives us our strength as a unique society. The problem with love is that it does not leave room for differentiation, and the mind and the heart will often go in different directions. Just loving people is not something, either, that you can ask of a state. Nor do many nations set out to be lovable. Many of them have had enormous success by being unlikable and even loathsome. Our society must be based on a different set of tensions, which includes emotion, but emphasizes analysis, acceptance, and curiosity. We cannot create a civil society by including only the people we like and with whom we share similar interests and goals. That is called friendship. And a society, a country, is more than friendship. The English philosopher Michael Oakeshott observed, "Friends are not concerned with what might be made of one another, but only with the enjoyment of each other. And the condition of this enjoyment is a ready acceptance of what is and the absence of any desire to change or to improve. A friend is not somebody one trusts to behave in a certain manner, who supplies certain wants, who has certain useful abilities, who possesses certain merely agreeable qualities, or who holds certain acceptable opinions. A friend is not useful. He is somebody who engages the imagination, who excites contemplation, who provokes interest, sympathy, delight, and loyalty simply on account of the relationship entered into. Oakeshott also goes on to say that one friend can never replace another. The relationship of friend to friend is dramatic and not utilitarian. The tie is one of familiarity, not usefulness. Friendship is a relationship sought and relished for its own sake and enjoyed for what it is, not for what you can get out of it. I sum it up by saying that you know somebody is your friend if you don't want to change them one bit. Much as friendship is a remarkable and necessary thing for individuals, we cannot build a society around it or base a society on it. Affectionate feelings will not cure all ills. And remember that just because somebody is not your friend does not imply that they are your enemy. The ground between us is where we have to operate as a decent society. Ubuntu is about the fundamental necessity of human relationship and acceptance of the other. It is not an emotional relationship. Countries can't be built on emotional relationships. The scale is simply too large. Our society has to continue to be created through the syncretic tensions inherent in our differences. Our true strength will come in building a good society not only with those whom we like, whom we admire, and share values with, but also those whom we do not like and whose values and inherent beliefs are different from our own. Just as they give us space, so must we give them their space. We must make society with people that we never want to have lunch with or even share a bus shelter with, but they're human too, just like us. It's with these people, as well as those we respect, love, and emulate, that we have to create our society. And the only way to accept what we do not like is to understand that it is part of the greater consciousness, part of a deeper understanding that we are related because we are human, that we belong to the world, just as those we dislike do, and that they play their part, just as we must play ours. We must look upon ourselves as fortunate because the Quran says that God could have made us all the same, but chose not to so we could be challenged to learn to live as one. The society we built here in Canada, the society we are building here, didn't just happen. It required vigilance, planning, and constant effort. And it still does. Our national anthem in French says, "O Canada, terre de nos aïeux." O Canada, the land of our ancestors. Although we are all different, we also come from roots, and roots have to be rooted somewhere. Our roots come together in the common desire to have a country. In this country where everybody came from somewhere else except for our Aboriginal peoples, we have become our own ancestors. Everybody is our ancestor. That is how we have lived. The past, the present, and the future are part of our own identities, our own being, our own time. Even though many languages are spoken now in this country, we have not built a Tower of Babel. We who came after the Aboriginal people have brought saints and heroes and honor them here, even though they were never over here. D.G. Jones, the poet, believed that Canada is less a question of nationalism than of an imaginative stance towards the world, towards nature and culture, past and present, the life of the body, and the life of the mind, the fact of death. It is a question of finding a satisfying interpretation of these fundamental elements in human life so that one can take a stand, act with definitive conviction, have an identity. I think the creation of a diverse, healthy society is ultimately a kind of religious quest. When the element of grace enters our active imagination, it is possible for us to change, to transmute, and to identify. So we must not live under the delusion that we can love other people into a democratic state. A society is about managing to live together with the maximum amount of liberty within a structure that provides enough security that we can exercise our responsibilities. People do not care only about themselves. All evidence points to the fact that most people in moments of acute crisis do not behave out of individual selfishness, but out of a sense of their connection to others. We always wish to be a part of something, and when we are part of that thing, our behavior shows that we know we depend on each other. Perhaps out of pure evolutionary selfishness, when we were so few and we had to save ourselves in those vast forests against those floods, our initial instinct is to reach out and help another human being. For over 6 years, I had the unique experience of giving out bravery awards to Canadians. You sometimes see a little thing written in the newspaper about them. The first time I really came to understand what this award meant, I was faced by the first bravery award, which was going to be given to 12 men, all of whom happened to be wearing dark blue suits. The citation read that these 12 men had rescued people from a highway in Saskatchewan after a tanker truck had ignited and was burning so intensely that the tarmac rolled up and melted. I assumed somehow that they were all members of the volunteer fire department. But no, I was wrong. These men had simply been taking a break in a coffee shop at a rest stop along the highway. A few were farmers, two of them were mechanics, others had office jobs. Some of them were volunteer firefighters in their towns. But somebody came running in and said, "A truck is burning up on the highway," and all of these men rushed out to help rescue the driver, to alert other drivers, to risk their lives. In another case, a man saw a truck ahead of him bursting into flames and swerved off the shoulder, shuddering to a stop. The car behind the man stopped, broke the window, and dragged the driver to safety minutes before the car exploded. In every case, those who had done the saving had never been in contact again with those that they had saved. The life was worth saving. The action was done. The meaning was there in the act. Before all this, I had always assumed that people risked their lives to save their family, their neighbors, their friends. But awarding these medals over the years, 6 years, made me aware that people help total strangers, endangering their own lives in the process. I remember speaking to the man who broke the window of the flaming truck to get the driver out, and I asked him what was in his mind. "Can you tell me what was in your mind as you did this?" And he answered, "I just looked at that guy, and I thought, that guy is me." No words could express Ubuntu more clearly. This was the total identification and imagining of the other. There's an intersection I frequently drive through that links the eastern part of Toronto with the western part, and I do it maybe 3 or 4 times a week. It's a 4-way stop without a light, with one road going through one of Toronto's most beautiful ravines, the Don River, and the other connecting commercial Bloor Street with leafy confines of the Rosedale neighborhood. The road that cuts through the ravine ultimately leads to a highway called the Don Valley Parkway, so it is a serious commuter artery. Whether it's rush hour or 1 o'clock on a quiet Sunday afternoon, every driver stops his car at this intersection and waits to take his turn, proceeding in counterclockwise fashion. To me, this is so quintessentially Canadian that I want to bring people from all over the world to this intersection to witness it. In France, which I know very well, 2 drivers would charge towards each other, rolling down their windows, shouting, and raising their fists. Perhaps only in Scandinavian countries could I imagine a similar scenario taking place. To me, this intersection represents the kind of Ubuntu we have in Canada. First and foremost, it shows self-restraint and the exercise of personal responsibility. And what I find particularly moving is the ability to wait for the other driver, to be patient if he doesn't go ahead when it's his turn, and instead to make eye contact across the intersection to engage him and let him know it is his turn. In the years that I have driven through this intersection, I have never seen a collision. These citizens are acting with public awareness within the context of basically healthy institutions. The sense of purpose and this awareness that other people occupy the same space keep our institutions, like Parliament, like the law, running smoothly. The German philosopher Jürgen Habermas notes, "The institutions of constitutional freedom are only worth as much as a population makes of them." That intersection would not work if we did not have civic awareness, if each citizen did not bring the values from his private life into this public sphere. It represents a citizen meeting his responsibility towards others with an equal measure of restraint and permission. Cooperation is another value that springs from this kind of spontaneous action. But the cooperation is utilitarian. It is in the citizen's self-interest to negotiate this intersection with efficiency and with no waste of emotional capital in order to get to where he was headed before he had to stop. He is also responsible not only for his own vehicle, but tacitly for the other three vehicles at that intersection. He has taken care not to damage the others, nor to hurt himself. This is Ubuntu as an organizing principle. It is in this realm of cooperation and consideration that modern citizens show virtue, or arete, as the Greeks call it. And it is this virtue that enables us to live together, to stay whole, to renew, to move beyond threat, to move beyond fear, to confirmed confidence in our institutions, in the way of life that we have chosen to construct together. Thank you.
From the Chan Center in Vancouver, you've been listening to Ubuntu, Adrian Clarkson delivering the fourth of the 2014 CBC Massey Lectures. This lecture was recorded by producer Yvonne Gall with recording engineer Gary Morgan. Through iTunes, you can buy audio copies of the 2014 CBC Massey Lectures series, Belonging, the Paradox of Citizenship. You can also buy the book of the lectures published by House of Anansi Press. In addition, you can explore the Massey Lectures series in an entirely new interactive way through the new Massey Lectures iPad app developed by House of Anansi. The app includes nearly 200 hours of text, audio lectures, interviews, talks, and exclusive footage. You should also check out our own website, cbc.ca/masseys. Special thanks to our community partners for the 2014 CBC Massey Lectures, the Institute for Canadian Citizenship, founded by Adrian Clarkson and John Ralston Saul, a national nonprofit that works to help accelerate new citizens' integration into Canadian life. The executive producers for the Massey Lectures were Bernie Lucht and Greg Kelly. The series was produced by Philip Coulter. Our partners in the Massey Lectures series are Massey College at the University of Toronto and House of Anansi Press. The executive producer of Ideas is Greg Kelly. I'm Paul Kennedy. Stay tuned to CBC Radio 1 and to SiriusXM for the hourly news.